This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning as we begin another week's worth of programs. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Faye Gersh. She is president of the Hemlock Society. It is the nation's oldest and largest right-to-die organization. She became president in 1996. Before that, she was a clinical and forensic psychologist practicing in San Diego. She also was the president and founder of the Hemlock Society of San Diego. She was here visiting in our area just about a week ago. Perhaps there are some people who are listening who had an opportunity to hear her speak. In any case, whether you did or did not, as we talk this morning, you can certainly feel free to join us and be a part of the conversation. If you have questions, comments, they are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just a little bit more about our guest. Faye Gersh earned her doctorate from Harvard University. She's taught at Morehouse College and the University of Chicago. The California and U.S. Supreme Courts have cited her research. She has published extensively in legal and psychological journals, including more than 30 articles on the right to die. She's joining us this morning by telephone. Dr. Gersh, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
How is it that you became involved in this issue, the right to die issue?
It wasn't a personal matter. I did it as a forensic psychologist. I examined a young quadriplegic woman in 1983 who wanted to admit herself into a hospital and refuse food and fluids to die. And at that time, that was not possible. But I just evaluated her because the court had to know whether she was competent, and I and many other people found her competent. But the issue, as I talked about it in the public, I found out that people had horrible experiences with their loved ones who were very ill and wanted to die, begged to die, and couldn't. And it seemed to me that this was a very important civil liberties issue that could potentially affect everybody's family, and so that's how I got involved.
And, of course, later in 1990, the Supreme Court in the Cruzan decision said essentially that Americans, that people have that right. That is, they have the right to refuse treatment, including food and water. And I'm not quite sure how many people have actually done that, but at that point the court said yes, that individuals have that right.
Yes, you're exactly right, and many people do take advantage of that, and in many cases hospice will help make them comfortable and make sure they have good oral hygiene, and people choose that as a way to hasten their death, and now it's quite acceptable.
I'm interested in your thoughts about what the polls, surveys on this issue tell us about what Americans think about the right to die. Apparently, it is the case now in a number of polls. There are different numbers, but polls seem to indicate that a majority of Americans favor some kind of assisted death, perhaps physician-assisted, although interestingly enough, fewer say that they would make that choice for themselves. But it appears that a majority, that is something like 70%, maybe more, say that people should have that option.
You're right. You're right about that. And that's true about doctors, too. The majority of doctors, when they're polled, favor legal physician aid in dying, even though the majority personally might be reluctant to provide that kind of help themselves. And it's not just an American phenomenon. It's in every developed country where we're living longer and better lives, but dying of chronic diseases, the support is over 70%. Australia, Canada, Europe, Japan, Great Britain, and all those countries, people want this option.
Well, specifically, do you think if you then engage people in some conversation about what it is they really want, what sort of choice they think should be available, is there some consensus there? Do people have a consistent idea about what it is that they think should be, what this option should be?
People want it for terminally ill, mentally competent adults, and they want it under careful safeguards. And they want, I think, more than what the Oregon law provides, which is that a physician prescribes a medication, then the patient takes it. The surveys indicate that people prefer that a doctor could give a lethal injection as well. That in other words, the decision on how to die would be made between the doctor and the patient.
Something else that I think is very striking and perhaps not surprising is that it seems that when you break down the way people feel according to their age, that is, younger people tend to favor this more than older people, which would suggest to me that as death becomes more of a reality, that is, as one is in a position actually to appreciate, understand your own mortality, people seem to be less in favor of having this option. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well, I'm not sure that's the correct finding. There was a huge study done of over 30,000 people over 65, and the vast majority favored legal physician aid in dying. So I guess it depends what survey you read. The audiences that I talk to tend to be older, and they seem to be very much in favor because the issue is very acute to them. So I'm not sure that it's worth debating whether it's more favored by young people or not, because I'm not sure the data are that clear.
Well, I guess the one that I'm thinking about here, I think, is Gallup, that found that 51% of those older than 65 favored it, as compared with 62% of those people between 18 and 29.
Yeah, I don't recall that particular poll, but there's certainly a lot of different surveys that I think show different things. But this one survey that was done in 1997 was the largest survey of people over 65, 30,000 respondents. So I don't know. I mean, we could easily speculate about why older people don't favor, but I'm just not sure that that's correct.
One other thing, and again, it's maybe this is just something that makes it interesting for an interesting argument, but I think that it was this same survey, or perhaps other surveys, have found that there's a very significant difference in the way that African Americans react to this as opposed to, I guess, white Americans, and that they tend to be much, much less in favor of this.
Yes.
And why do you think that would be?
I think it's a combination of poor access to health care, which is of much more concern to them, and the possibilities of what would happen at the end of life if they didn't have good access to health care, and also stronger religious beliefs.
And perhaps also, I guess, as I've seen it suggested, some feeling that the health care system has not provided good care for African Americans in the past, and perhaps there's some suspicion that they would not be well cared for and perhaps wouldn't have the kind of options that others would.
That's right. That's what I was trying to suggest, yeah. And that's certainly something to be concerned about.
Well, given the fact, if indeed these kinds of surveys are correct, that a majority of Americans favor this choice being there, why is it that so far only one state, that is the state of Oregon, has made this legal?
Well, there have been initiatives in six states, or six different initiatives. Two of them, of course, were in Oregon. And of those, five had more than 45% of the voters said yes, they wanted this. In Washington, the first one in 1991, it was 46%. In California, the next year, it was 46%. Then in Oregon in 1994, 51%. In 1997, 60%. And last year in Maine, 49% of the voters said yes. But what we're up against is Hemlock is a grassroots organization, and these state initiatives have been floated by grassroots organizations who have just funding from regular individuals. And the opposition comes primarily from the Catholic Church and now from Right to Life organizations, which have pretty vast funding sources. So, for example, in Michigan, where we lost severely in 1998, although we came in with 70% support, went down to 29%. Almost $6 million was spent to defeat that initiative, with funds like $1.5 million coming from the Diocese of Detroit, and the rest coming from the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Catholic Hospital Associations, Sisters of Mercy, and other Catholic-related organizations. And in Maine, the money came from the Christian Doctors and Dentists Group, National Right to Life, and those kind of things. So really we're talking about corporate spending here, which is very hard in a grassroots initiative to combat. And I think that's the reason, although I think over 45% of the vote is a pretty substantial showing in five states.
I guess I wonder whether it's possible that people would feel conflicted about the issue to the extent that they would say in principle, in the abstract, they think the idea of being able to provide people with this choice is good. However, they also maybe harbor some concern that it might not be possible to devise a system so that we would make certain that this would indeed be a person's free choice. There would be no coercion. That is, they like the idea, but when you come to putting it in practice, then they start to have concerns.
Well, you know that argument was made about hospice 20 years ago, that the HMOs would push people into hospice care because it was much cheaper than another chemo or bone marrow transplant or whatever treatment could be offered to people. And in fact, there was some evidence that that was happening, and of course that got cleared up because once it's above board and open, any possible abuses can be monitored and regulated. The same arguments were made in 1976 when the first living will law was passed about the potential abuses of having a person fill out an advance directive that said, if there's no hope for my recovery, I don't want any heroic measures. And what about the wrong diagnosis? And what about greedy people pushing them into this? And then the same thing when the first state, 1983, passed a law saying that people can designate someone to speak for them in healthcare situations, including life and death situations, and the possibilities for abuse there were vast. But still, people preferred that to the possibility that they couldn't speak for themselves. And I think the same thing is true here. And certainly we've seen in Oregon since 1997 a law that works quite well. It's very restrictive, but there's no indication that there's been any abuses. And it's been used by very few people, 70 people in 3 years. But the majority of Oregonians favor this law, and they just want to know that there's an option, a way out if their suffering becomes too great. So I think there's every evidence that it can be controlled and it can be regulated, and it's much better than the unregulated practice we have now where we know that physicians help people die, but we don't know under what circumstances or we don't have any written documentation from these patients or anything. So we have a choice here. We can go on keeping our head in the sand, or we can regulate, monitor, and openly have such laws.
Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 is Faye Gersh. She is president of the Hemlock Society. It is the nation's oldest, largest right-to-die organization. She's been president of Hemlock since 1996, and before that was president and founder of the Hemlock Society of San Diego. Before becoming involved with her present post, she was a clinical and forensic psychologist practicing in San Diego. We have a couple of callers. Anybody's welcome into the conversation. We ask only people try to be brief so we can accommodate everyone, but anyone's welcome to call 333-WILL or 9455. The toll-free 800-222-WILL. First caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello?
Hi. I think you may be giving a false impression of the attitude of people towards assisted suicide. On the one hand, you say that it's gaining ground. It doesn't appear to be people favoring assisted suicide seem to be gaining ground. I don't believe they are, because apparently American attitudes favoring assisted suicide peaked at the time of the Oregon referendum, and you referred to that, in which Oregon did indeed approve the right to die. But Oregon was the only state. You yourself just said a few minutes ago that six other states, At the time the Oregon referendum was approved, the sentiment was that this right to die was going to sweep the country, and it did not. It has been offered, as you say, in six other states, and it has failed in every one. And by your own statement now, you said that it's failing by majorities, 54% in most states, and I guess you said that only 49% of the people in the last referendum voted in favor of assisted suicide. I think that was the statistic you gave. Also, when the Supreme Court was considering a right to die law, it was considering the constitutionality of a right to die law. There was a large demonstration at the Supreme Court by impaired people, people with all kinds of impairments, people in wheelchairs filled the area around the Supreme Court, down the street, around the corner. They were remonstrating against any idea that they were unfit to live because they were impaired. The idea that quality of life, that the sacredness of life should be disparaged. Here were these impaired people, and they said, look, our lives are just as worthy, we are just as worthy of life as others, and we should not be put under pressure to die. I know one specific example of a woman. Her name is Johnny Erickson Tata. She's a paraplegic. She graduated from high school, she had a tragic accident in which she dove off a diving board into too shallow water. She broke her neck, and she's now paraplegic. Shortly after her injury, when she knew that she would never walk again, she wanted to die. But now it's 40 years later, and she has lived a productive life. She can paint. She does beautiful paintings, mouth paintings, by holding a paintbrush in her mouth. She has lived a productive life and been a blessing to many people. And she thinks back. I've heard her say from her own lips, if I would have been allowed to die, I would have been dead now, and all of that productivity and all of that blessing would have been.
You've asked two good questions, and let's give the guest a chance to respond. The caller is suggesting that, in fact, the support for the right to die has not been growing, but that it peaked in 1997, and I don't know if suggesting that it's been declining.
Right, I understand. And I don't agree with that. I didn't say only 49% of the people in Maine. I said 49%. So we lost by 19,000 votes, 1.5%. We would have won the election. So I don't think that's evidence that the support is waning at all.
Lost by 59%.
Despite the fact that we're now fighting both the Catholic Church and the Right to Life organizations. Secondly, I was there at the Supreme Court. There were 70 people in wheelchairs. Well, not all in wheelchairs. And that was Not Dead Yet, an organization that does oppose it. And then there were groups there from the Hemlock Society that favored it. So, and we have a paraplegic man on our board who is in favor of the right to die for all people, including people with disabilities. And this group doesn't particularly speak for all people with disabilities, as repeated surveys of people who are classified under the Americans for Disabilities Act show. And as far as Ms. Potter goes, if she were in a situation, which she probably was, like Christopher Reeve can end his life anytime by unplugging himself from the respirator that sustains his life. There's no argument about that. There's no legal quarrel. If he chose to do it, he could do it.
How would he do that?
Just take himself off the respirator.
How would he do that? He can't move his hands.
No, he could have a doctor do it. That's perfectly legal.
Well, that's what I say. He can't do it himself. When Johnny Erickson Tata wanted to die, she said that she would. The only thing she could do was to jerk her head. She would try to jerk.
No, I understand what you're saying, but I'm just saying that in 1990, the Supreme Court said that every American has the right to refuse any unwanted medical treatment for any reason, even if it should lead to their death. So Christopher Reeve, at any time, can say to a doctor, disconnect me from this respirator and allow me to die.
Yes.
James Michener said that when he died. Richard Nixon said it when he died.
The point that I'm trying to make is that Johnny Erickson Tata would have requested that death.
I understand.
She would have. Now, 40 years later, she is so glad that she did.
Let me ask another question. I'm just curious because the caller raises this example in the context of the kinds of laws that we've been talking about. Would an individual like the person he describes, someone who, say, was in an accident and became paraplegic, who would be expected, even though that injury had been sustained, to live some years afterwards, would they be allowed to ask to die? Could they ask to die under the Oregon law?
No, not under the Oregon law, because they would not be terminal.
No, so the kind of law we're talking about in Oregon, this kind of right to die law, does not apply to the case that the caller gives.
No, but I'm saying that the laws on the books already do apply. She's quadriplegic. She's not paraplegic.
Oh, okay.
I'm assuming that she's also on a ventilator, I don't know, and that she could disconnect at any time and choose to die or choose to continue living as she has done. And nobody has a problem with that, nor do they have with Christopher Reeve.
I guess the reason that I raise the question is simply because the law that we're talking about applies to people who are terminally ill.
The law in Oregon does.
In Oregon.
Yeah, but here's the problem. The law, that kind of law implies that people that have an impairment are less worthy of life than those people who are perfectly whole. And, you know, by the way, we all have an impairment of some kind.
It doesn't imply that at all. I mean, less than 0.1% of people who die in Oregon take advantage of that law, and more than 70% of those people have hospice care. But most of the people who are terminally ill in Oregon don't choose to do that. Nobody requires them to do it. It's just an option that people can take advantage of.
If that implication does not exist, then why were all those impaired people demonstrating at the Supreme Court? Why wasn't it whole people? Why wasn't it unimpaired people who were demonstrating against any Supreme
Court? There were many people who were unimpaired who were in front of the Supreme Court that day.
I know, but massively. There was a great line of wheelchairs.
No, there were 70 people there. That's all there were. I mean, this does not represent every person who has an impairment in the United States.
I'm going to have to.
One group of disabled people who don't like this law.
I'm going to have to jump in here. We're already at our midpoint. I have two other people holding. We've been spending quite a lot of time with this particular caller, so I'm going to move on. Let me again introduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Faye Gersh. She is the president of the Hemlock Society and has been since 1996. We're talking about the issue of the right to die. Questions are welcome. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have somebody here on a car phone, and I hope that our first caller in Urbana won't mind if I go to the car phone person next here on line two in Champaign. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for going to me. I'll be brief as possible. I have a disability, and let me get on. I have a disability, and I understand the caller's defense of those with disabilities. However, I don't think he has a disability himself by the way he talked. He may be defender of those with disabilities, and I really do appreciate that because there are too many people who do not see the worth of individuals who have disabilities. And too many times those with disabilities or who are identified in the womb with disabilities are aborted. We have a method of identifying those in the womb who have Down syndrome, and we can abort them, and many people feel that that is an appropriate behavior. And I understand where the fear of those with disabilities, where that comes from. We don't want to be eliminated. Our lives are worthwhile. And when the caller referred to whole people, well, I'm a whole person, too. Just because I have a disability doesn't mean that I'm not a whole person. And I know he didn't mean any derogatory thing by that, but that is the thing that we fear. However, at the same time, I'm very much in favor of having the ability to end suffering in my life. I don't consider my disability suffering. That's not how I think about it. I am not a terminal patient. I have a handicap that I have to cope with, and I do, but I don't consider myself suffering. On the other hand, were I in a terminally ill situation where I was suffering immensely, there was no hope for the future, I don't believe that a religious-based ethic that says, I have been given this life to live and I must continue to live it, is appropriate for me. And I do have, and I will reserve my personal right without the infliction of any religious or any other group on me to determine that I have to suffer and continue to suffer. I'll make that decision for myself, not anyone else. So I just wanted to respond to that, and thank you for letting me speak.
All right. Thank you for the comment. Ms. Gersh, did you want to...
Well, that's essentially the argument was made in Elizabeth Bouvier's case, the case that I was involved in 1983, that people with ability and people with disabilities all have the same right to make these kinds of decisions at the end of their own lives.
All right. Well, I thank the caller very much. Let's go on to someone else here. Been patient with us in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Howdy. I'd like to confirm one of the statistics that you mentioned before about that as people get older, they tend not to vote for this kind of thing. It's pretty simple, really. As old as I am, I've watched it happen with hundreds or thousands of people that I know. People just tend to narrow their scope as they get older, and they don't like to think as much outside the box. They go with what's comfortable, and they don't rock the boat nearly as much. And it's very statistically relevant, and there are a lot more studies to pick up on that kind of stuff than the one that you quoted.
All right. Well, Ms. Gersh, you want to comment on that at all?
Yeah, well, I still think we're not talking about the same data, so I think that the evidence doesn't show that older people are opposed to this, but I think maybe his hypothesis is correct.
All right. Any caller, anything else?
I just wanted to thank you for giving everybody so much time before. I didn't mind waiting at all.
Okay.
I've heard you cut people off before, and I'm really glad you didn't.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call, and other people who are listening are certainly welcome to be involved in the conversation. All you need to do is pick up the phone and call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I wonder if I could ask you to respond to a point I'm certain that you have to deal with all the time, and that is people will make the argument that by sanctioning what is in effect suicide for as an end to distress, in this case the pain and suffering that comes with terminal illness, by sanctioning a suicide in that case, what we're doing is giving a more general sanction to people who are experiencing other kinds of distress. Now, I know that you've said in the Hemlock Society formal literature, you say that you oppose suicide for emotional reasons, but how can we to say to that person who is in that kind of pain that they are not entitled to end their life, and yet we can say to the person who is in physical pain that you are entitled to end your life?
Well, the reason we don't support suicide for emotional reasons is that most of that is transient, and over time and with treatment, that evaporates. As a psychologist for 30 years, I could never support suicide for those kinds of reasons, and for that reason, that it goes away. But we're talking about people whose suffering is physical, and it's not going to go away. It's going to get worse. I'm reminded of one of our chapter leaders in Alaska who had ALS, a young man, and after he died, his letter was published in the Anchorage Daily News, and it started out by saying, I abhor suicide, but I know that in my life, my suffering today is not as bad as my suffering is going to be tomorrow, and that every subsequent day it's going to get worse, and so I've made plans to end my life. And I think it's quite a different story, and I don't think we at all sanction suicide. And I think an interesting point is that suicide is not an illegal act in this country. And one of the reasons is that we have medicalized it. We want to help people who are feeling suicidal. But in this case, where people are suffering at the end of the life, we have made it a crime, not for people to end their own lives, but for doctors to help them. And that has essentially driven it to an underground practice, and as I said, which is not monitored, not regulated, and which is not accessible to many people. And so consequently, what we find is people, I'm reminded of a publisher in Michigan who had Alzheimer's, which is not a terminal illness, of course, but he went out in his front lawn and shot himself and wrote a note explaining why he did that. And many people are helping their loved ones die, and it's very difficult. Some of those people wind up in jail or prosecuted or charged with a crime. And other people, doctors, for example, are breaking the law, not overtly but covertly. And we know from surveys that somewhere between, depending on which survey you read, 6% and 53% of doctors already provide this kind of help to patients. So if we're really concerned about abuses, I think we need to know that this is going on, both by family members and by doctors, and also by patients who are trying to figure out what their solutions are. And I don't think it's the kind of thing we want to see in this country, people breaking the law and people traumatizing their family by shooting themselves, hanging themselves. A symphony conductor in Canada, for example, had terminal cancer, threw himself out of a fifth-story apartment that he lived in order to end his life and his suffering. And this is not the way loved ones should have to die in this country. Hmm. On May 16th, we would probably watch Timothy McVeigh die a gentle, peaceful, quick, and certain death. And this is reserved for the worst people in our country, but not for the people that we love.
We have several callers. The lines, in fact, are full. We'll take people in the order they came in. Have a couple of champagne people. First is line number one. Hello?
Excuse me. Sorry. great show. I just like to make a comment that I, having been someone who has worked with perhaps people living with a chronic mental illness for a long time, I think we do have to be careful in assessing people when you're talking about, you know, just giving people easy access, which I know you're not, but I think we do have to be careful because different doctors do use different standards, and I think you would find a wide variety of application. But I do think we have the right to die. I want to agree with you on that. And I'm wondering if you would be interested in answering a philosophical question. Do you think this just goes along with Americans' denial of death? When, you know, we don't talk about people dying. When I know an older individual, he's in his 80s, he's been living with MS since 1943, he has leukemia as well, and for him, death is not scary. But it's very scary for everyone around him. You know, and I think he's very comfortable at the end of his life with the fact that his life is going to end someday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of this controversy, I really do, comes down to Americans' denial of death. And
I agree with you, and I think that's why only about 15% of us have advanced directives, living wills, and durable power of attorney for health care. And I commend organizations like Rotary Clubs, which sometimes invite people from Hemlock to speak, but more often don't want to touch the subject at all. And I think you're right. And many people say to me, well, this is a joke, but I'm planning to live forever, and so far so good. And they just think that somehow it's going to be taken care of. And some people say, well, I've got three children, and they'll handle it. Or I've got a sympathetic doctor, or I've got a living will, so I don't have to worry about it. Now, there's a tremendous denial of death, and more people willing to talk about what kind of burial arrangements they want than what kind of death they want.
All right, let's go on. Let's go to another champagne person. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. I just wonder if you could comment on the concern that this sort of movement, it tends to feed into a general cultural sense, not so much of choice, but of obligation. So doesn't it feed into a notion that as people get older and reach a point where they feel they become a burden on their relatives, I think there's a difference between choosing for reasons that have to do with your own well-being or your own pain and choosing because you feel you're now an obligation, you're a burden on people, so it's an obligation.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if you've had any thoughts about just that general cultural. It seems to me that there's a way in which this feeds into a general cultural movement that would suggest as people get older or as people get weaker or as people get less able to take care of themselves,
right.
Totally appropriate, in fact, a responsibility to end your life so as not to be a burden on the people you love.
Right. And, of course, this was personified when Governor Dick Lamb was misquoted, but he talked about an obligation to die. And I guess the general context was, as governor of a state, you have X number of resources, which are fairly finite. Mm-hmm. And then you have to figure out how to allocate these in the best way, including health, road building, education, mm-hmm. and end-of-life care. And so that's the context in which he was quoted about people having an obligation to die.
Right.
And the Dutch, who have legal physician aid in dying, look at us and say, Americans have third-party euthanasia. That is, our insurance companies, our government, our hospitals decide who's going to live and who's going to die. But in most cases, except in Oregon, where they have rationing, not age rationing, but rationing, it's implicit in the system and not explicit. So we certainly get pressure sometimes from our HMOs, who are discharging most of their Medicare patients now, to not have expensive treatments and to not go to extensive measures for people who are old. And many people choose to stop treatment because they do feel that they're an obligation to their family, that their money, the money would be better spent educating their grandchildren than...
So this doesn't trouble you as a part of your... you know, I'm a person, for example, who, unlike the way you were characterizing people who might be opposed to this or worried about it, I am pro-choice with respect to reproductive issues, mm-hmm. nor, and I'm also not Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, somehow conflating all those issues into one thing as a way, as a part of an argument, makes me a little uncomfortable. But
mm-hmm. Well,
I'm just wondering.
We're not conflating them here. I mean, we're talking about two choice issues, which are totally independent, and we're not really talking about a woman's right to and terminate her pregnancy. We're talking about a person's right to end his or her life with medical assistance. We already have the right to end our lives, and we're not making an issue about how difficult or easy it is, actually, to get a gun and shoot ourselves. Mm-hmm. And most people who end their lives choose that means. We don't think that's the way people should have to die.
Well, I'll get off and let other people talk. I just, my point would simply be that it's important to remember in favoring just what you're favoring that it's also a contribution to a general cultural presumption that maybe we actually have an obligation to get out of the way. Now, that's
I understand what you're saying.
People ought to think about. That's
yeah, I don't see that in Oregon, where, as I said, less than 0.1% of people choose to accelerate their death by a day or a week using the Death with Dignity law, because the vast majority, over 99% of the people in Oregon, choose to die a natural death, and more people in Oregon have a choice now of using hospice care than in any other state, and that's what they do choose to do. And that's, we're perfectly fine with that. And if nobody chooses to accelerate their death, that's fine with us, too. All we're saying is that people should have the choice.
Hmm. Just real quick, I'm looking here at the Oregon law, the way that it has been written in the section that says who may initiate a written request for medication. And it says that it has to be an adult who is capable, who's a resident of Oregon, who's been determined by an attending physician and consulting physician to be suffering from a terminal disease. I guess my question is there anything in this law that says something about how close to the end of the life the person is supposed to be?
6 months or less.
6 months or less.
Yeah.
All right. And it says that somewhere in the law?
Yes, it does.
It does, okay.
Mm-hmm. It defines terminal. It defines all the terms at the end of the law, and terminal is defined as with reasonable medical certainty, that is the examination by two independent physicians, that a person is determined to have 6 months or less to live.
I see. And you feel certain that if a law like this is enacted, that it's possible to maintain these narrow restrictions so that we continue only to be talking about people who have terminal disease and who are expected to live only 6 months or less?
Well, this may sound like I'm changing the subject, but if I were alive 150 years ago, I would have said with the majority that only white males who own property can vote in this country. We're not able to predict how things expand. I mean, 50 years ago, we had no idea how computers would affect our lives and what laws we needed to regulate that. I mean, we had no idea 100 years ago how the automobile would affect our life. So, no, I certainly couldn't make any guarantee that any law in this country would stay exactly like it was when it was passed. I mean, we thought in 1976 when we passed the first living will law in California that that was really very adequate and would help a lot of people. And it took a long time even for every state to adopt that. And the one in California was way too restrictive. Nobody could die under it. And it's been modified in every state since then. So laws change and people's needs change, and I certainly would never predict that any law would stay the same as it was when it was passed.
A little less than 10 minutes in this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Faye Gersh. She is president of the Hemlock Society of the USA, has been president since 1996. Before that, she was a clinical and forensic psychologist practicing in San Diego. She was also the president and founder of the Hemlock Society of San Diego. Your questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's talk next with someone in rural Charleston, I believe, on line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
There is one form of terminal illness that never seems to be brought up by those opposed to the right to die, and that's a cerebral stroke that leaves you completely and totally paralyzed, unable to communicate in any way. I'd like to relate what happened to my great-uncle John, who suffered a stroke at 70, from which he partially recovered. And 8 months later, a total stroke. And he unfortunately lived for about a year, unable to move, unable to communicate. The only thing he could do was cry. And I'd like you all to visualize what a horrible prison this would be, unable to communicate in any way, and may be suffering excruciating pain since the sensory system may not have been impaired in the stroke. In my own case, I may give up many good years of life because the first stroke I have, if I'm fortunate enough to recover, I'm going to end my own life at the first possible moment. I would not take the risk of going through this incredibly suffering that would occur when the next stroke occurred. Now, the next one might not occur, but I'm going to sacrifice some maybe good years solely for the fear that someone will not mercifully end my life with a nice lethal injection. I don't care for them to do it by starving to death. I'd probably be miserable enough without having to go through that as well by just disconnecting the feeding tubes. I'd like a nice lethal injection to get it over with.
Well, Ms. Gersh,
there's your answer, Mr. Inge. You said, how do you contain a law to terminal illness? As I said, most of the people I speak to are older, and they have stories very much like Uncle John's story. And what they fear more than terminal illness is irreversible disability, like Alzheimer's, like stroke. So, yes, I think it's foreseeable that the law will expand to include these kinds of very, very difficult chronic illnesses, which people dread, and do what this caller said he would do. Mm-hmm. And there's a book, actually, on this subject called Preemptive Suicide, and that's what he's talking about, that in order to avoid a year, as Uncle John had, of disability, he would end his life while he still could, while he still had a quality of life, even though he would prefer to know that he could get a lethal injection when the time came. And so many people make this choice to give up some quality of life. Janet Atkins, Kevorkian's first patient, had Alzheimer's and went to him while she still was mentally and physically capable of asking for help and assisting in her own death, and would have preferred to live longer and to be able to get a lethal injection when at some point she said this is enough, but instead she had to do it while she still could. And so I'm certainly in sympathy with this, and yes, people are going to want more than terminal illness.
Well, I want to thank the caller very much. I appreciate his call. I do have two other people, and I'd like to try to try to get at least one more. Champagne is up next, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My wife died from cancer, and after the operations and the therapies, et cetera, she tried suicide, botched, didn't succeed, and eventually died. I am also a survivor of colon cancer, and I'm nearing 75. I would love to be able to go into a doctor or clinic and ask for an injection and just end my life. I think that many people do not attempt the suicide route because they're afraid of botching it. They don't know how to do it. They're not sure that they will succeed. So because they can't be convinced and sure that they will succeed, they don't make an attempt, an effort. I suspect that a lot of people who do try to take their life really do botch those attempts. I think we really need to have control of our life, and when we reach a point where life is simply not worth continuing, be able to go in and have it terminated.
The data show that about 50% of people who attempt to end their lives do fail. He's absolutely right. And I do want to mention that the Hemlock Society has a program for people who are members who are suffering from hopeless physical conditions and are considering a hastened death. And one of the goals of the program is to make sure that it's not botched. And so I would recommend to your callers, if they have concerns like this man does, to give us a call at 800-247-7421 and find out what the Hemlock Society has to offer, because this is a concern that we've had for 21 years. Our twin goals are to legalize physician-assisted dying and to help people plan for a peaceful death. And I absolutely agree that people are worried about making a complete mess of it. Even if they have a gun, many people shoot their eye out instead of ending their lives. So he's absolutely right.
Well, we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have one more caller we can't take. I'm certain, though, it's an issue that we'll continue to discuss. For the moment, I want to say to our guest, Dr. Gersh, thanks very much for talking
to
us.
You're welcome. And we do have a website, hemlock.org. And this is what we're about. So if people still have questions, please give us a call.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our guest, Dr. Faye Gersh, she is president of the Hemlock Society.